The story in Genesis 14 is definitely going to fit our time. Hopefully it won't be a reality for any of us. In Genesis 14, armed invaders kidnap the nephew. And then Uncle Abram goes right after them, taking his own militia to get him back. Well, so far we haven't had it that bad. We hope it'll stay that way. But Abram had a situation where it was no police were left. No army was left. It was either the family does something or nobody does anything. And that gives one of the unusual examples of a threat of violence in a Bible story. So it will have current applications, and that will be where we spend most of our time. We begin Genesis 14 with a long list of cities, and I don't think I want to read all of Genesis 14 at the beginning with all the cities, but some of them have been found by archaeologists. So I think it would be good to at least mention that part of it. The outline will be rebellion, rescue, and return. Begins with background to a rebellion, and we'll just look at some of the cities in Genesis 14, 1 and 2. Came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Ariok, king of Eliezer, Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim. Goyim means Gentiles. We're all Goy. That they made war with Bera, the king of Sodom, Bersha, the king of Gomorrah, and then there's others, and one town got named Zoar, an update. The reason I mention these cities is that archaeologists have found many clay tablets in northern Syria. This is old news, 1974, 1977. Some have translated them as all these cities of the plain. And that would be a hard job to get a language that no one knows and figure out what it's talking about. But some at the time did translate them as all the cities of the plain. 4 years later, they fight back and forth, and minimally there are two of them that are accurately translated from the time, and one of them is Sodom. Zeboim is the other thing. So don't have archaeologists finding Abram's tent. That's too much to expect. But very often the cities have been found and names in the tablets. Sodom is one of them. Earlier towns were Ur, Nahor, and Haran. All of them have been found. Verse 3, there's another reason to read about this with, say, archaeology and finds. Verse 3, all these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Sea of Salt. Now, it was a valley when it happened. Now it's underwater. It was a valley in Abram's day, and Moses has to explain. Now it's, right near the beach or right underwater. Now, that can happen. The area had an upheaval. Later we're going to look at the explosion in Sodom. The area has had earthquakes. The area has had much salt. It has had problems. And so if they were to look for things, it's actually maritime archaeology. Things were sinking. That's actually true, that some things that were up above the ground in Abram's day were in Moses' time below the ground. Now we're getting closer to the rebellion. The cities, including Sodom and Gomorrah, were underneath an overlord in what we call Mesopotamia, Iraq, and they rebelled. And then the Mesopotamians start to come to attack. So we'll look at the verse 4. Just read that one. 12 years they have served Kedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. And all about the armies are coming to attack Sodom and Gomorrah. Might look at tar pits again in verse 10. Tar pits. Now, verse 11, they steal Lot. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. They also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite. They were all his brothers, and they were all friends with Abram. The cities of the plain, including Sodom and Gomorrah, had been underneath the overlords up in Mesopotamia. This fits the archaeological finds that are known at the time. They did not have nations in that area like we think of nations. They had city-states. And there were the country people living in tents outside the city, but they had city-states. And Lot has been, for the last two chapters, using the title of the book, slouching towards Gomorrah. He left Uncle Abram, then moved closer to Sodom. Here he's in Sodom. What is interesting about the story as it goes on, after his uncle rescues him, he will go back to Sodom. We'll find him again living in Sodom. In other words, he was slouching towards Gomorrah, and his uncle had to decide, you know, do I take a risk and rescue him? Do I risk my life to get the nephew back? Well, he judged that was the right thing to do, and he would do the right thing, but evidently, Lot didn't care. When it was all done, he didn't reconcile with his uncle. He moved right straight back to Sodom, where we'll find him on the inside, and we'll find the destruction later as we read on. I read verse 13 on purpose. It's the first reference to the word Hebrew in the Bible. Verse 13, a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Probably named after Eber, the ancestor in the Table of Nations, and it means division. Also, there is lots of references in archaeology to the Habaru. The Habaru are like refugees. They would say the crossover types. People who don't stay in one place. They move along. So Abraham is a Hebrew in the sense that he moved around. He moved from Ur to the Promised Land, but he also moved in the Promised Land from tent to tent. To use the New Testament, he was a pilgrim. No place was like home. He's actually the owner in God's view, but no place is like home. It's kind of like us. No place is really home. Even if we stay in one place a long time, no place is really home. So he is a Hebrew, which means division, a new country coming from Abram, and it means a crossover, someone who treks around, someone who moves along, and that's where the word Hebrew comes from, and this is the first reference. Now a nephew is stolen, and Abram has to decide what to do, and more attention now to verses 14 through 16. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men born in his house. 318. 318 kids born in his house. And went in pursuit as far as Dan. So that I mention it. They've dug up Dan. They have found buildings that Abram would have seen. There are some of them. City gates of Dan and so forth. Verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them. And pursued them as far north as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He went way up, north of Syria. Verse 16, he brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions and all the women and all the people. Well, Abram been minding his own business out there in central Israel. We'd say ranching, we'd say farming, shepherding sheep. His nephew made the decision to leave him, slouch towards Gomorrah. He got himself into this. You know, the old movie, this is another fine mess you've got me into. Lot made it. He moved there. He got in it. Abram has to decide. Will he take a risk, risk his life? Will he try to get him back? Will he protect the family? Abram does what seems to be the right thing and is the right thing. And when it's all done, Lot will move back to Sodom. But Abram made the choice of doing the right thing. So he had no police. That's one thing to keep in mind. There were no police left in Sodom and Gomorrah. There was no army left in Sodom and Gomorrah. It was either the family do it or nobody does it. Now, that is a factor as we apply this. On the other hand, it's an example of an ongoing danger. It wasn't over and done with. It's an ongoing threat. American way of thinking, a clear and present danger. It's right now. It's not like it's over and done with. Now, before we moved to Texas, we lived in Pennsylvania. And there are a lot of good things about central Pennsylvania in the rural parts and small town parts. We did, though, have an interesting difference than either Michigan or Texas. There were lots of pacifists in Pennsylvania. You never fight. You never fight no matter what. And when the military recruiters would come to the high schools, the pastors would show up and try to block them from coming and block them from making speeches because their members did not want the kids hearing about the military and being offered to them. So I say that to say I've thought a lot about this, having come from that background. And it is true, Jesus said, turn the other cheek. So we've thought a lot about that. I would say a slap in the cheek is in the category of a deepest insult without a life and death danger. And it's something that, as Jesus would speak, is over and done with. So it's a very deep insult, about as deep an insult as you can think of, and over and done with, not a life and death danger, and done with if you don't respond. So there's a good deal of being nice and patient. There's a good deal of, say, an insult, a very serious insult, but not a life danger. And something that's over and done with, now you have to respond. It's not an ongoing death threat. So I would make a distinction between an insult, and the Bible tells us to be very patient with insults, and the Bible tells us to be very patient with something that's not life and death and is over and done with. On the other hand, in Abram's situation, it is a clear and present danger. It's not over and done with, and it is a threat of death to the family. The Bible does teach not to take personal revenge after something is over and done with. You know, it's done. On the other hand, there are examples of, shall we say, a forceful protection of the innocent. And you've heard these texts before, because whenever it comes up, I think of Proverbs 24, 11, and 12. Deliver those being led away to death. That's the story here. They're in danger. And nobody else is going to help. It's a present danger. It's ongoing. It's not over and done with. And it's not an insult. Deliver those being led away to death. If you say, we did not know this, does he not consider who weighs the hearts? Does he not know who keeps your soul? And will he not render to everyone according to his works? That's Proverbs 24, 11, and 12. It seems like protecting the innocent from death. Deliver those being led away into death. Job also gives an example in Job 29, 17. I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. Now, that's the situation where Job has boils and all his counselor friends are saying, you must have done wrong. And his response is, no, I don't do any wrong. I broke the teeth of the wicked and I delivered people from the wicked. So we have Proverbs 24 and Job 29. Genesis 14 gives us the story of Abram. And Moses included it. Now, when I think of Moses, when he went to the well at Midian, it was not a life and death threat, but they were harassing the girls. Moses didn't put up with it. So he is in the story where he got his spear and sword out and used violence, but he didn't put up with it. Here's Exodus 2:14. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered the flocks. And then the seven girls, young women, go back to their dad, and a couple of verses later in Exodus 2, the Egyptian delivered us from the hands of the shepherds. And what is more, he drew water for us and watered the flock. It is interesting that Moses was timid. In Numbers 11, there's not a more timid person in the world. Real quiet, real timid. But when they were harassing the young women, he didn't necessarily fight with violence, but he told them to stop. So there's all these stories where it's not just an insult, it's a danger. And it's not right. And there isn't any police to call, and something has to be done. Now, I do know of a story around here. I know this person personally. It was in the house. Kids were outside. Someone stops, trying to get the kids to get in the car. And the man ran out, and it wasn't violent, but it wasn't nice. Now, this person's in a generation younger than me. And I know for a fact it's true. I know the person. And it was tough. So if you're dealing with a situation where there is danger, not an insult, it's over, not over and done with. It's right now there's a threat. And there's no one else to help. You have all these Bible stories. And there's a good deal of what you might call warriors and defenders in the Bible. So, I would conclude that if a person is in actual danger, force is God's will. Now, I feel differently about property, and you'll have to think about this. I remember in our hometown, when I was in college, there was a younger kid that stole a mini bike. I do know he was dead at the end of it. I think the police killed him, but it could be the homeowner killed him. And that made me think about the difference between property and a life and death situation. I did not agree with killing a 15-year-old boy over a mini bike. Don't agree with it. Now, if you want to, you know where he is, follow him out down the road. Follow him out to wherever he's going. Take your time. I don't quite agree with property in the same as threats, same as harm, same as violence. Now, you can think about that, but I don't. When I look at the law of Moses, it's kind of interesting. There was a homeowner at night and a homeowner at day. A homeowner at night, Moses said, if there's something that seems threatening to the family and you get rid of them, that was okay. During the day in the law of Moses, you can see what they're doing. This is before the days of, say, long distance guns and things, but you can see what they're doing during the day. And if it were just a matter of property, you couldn't kill them for the property. So you can make that's the law of Moses. We're not under the law of Moses, so you can make your own decision on that. But based upon the story of the mini bike years ago, I had decided a long time ago, there's the car. I wouldn't kill a kid over the car. I wouldn't want it done. On the other hand, there's quite a few stories in the Bible, if it is a life threat, and it's right now, it's ongoing, there's lots of stories where they fight back. In Luke chapter 3, the soldiers go to John the Baptist and basically, to modernize the question, shall we quit? And John the Baptist said, go back and do a good job. So the lesson being, it was okay to serve God in the army, and John the Baptist didn't want them all quitting. So he went and rescued his nephew. It was not a petty insult. It was serious, and it was right now. It wasn't over and done with. He went and did something about it. And I think that's a story that gives us an example of a right now is the danger. It's a real danger. It's not done with. He went and got his nephew. Even though his nephew didn't appreciate it and moved right back, wow. Okay, when he got back, he met Melchizedek. And that's the second part of the study. Verse 17, he met the king of Sodom. Alrighty. And then in verse 18, he met the king of Salem, verse 18 and following. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was the priest of the Most High God. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abram, gave him a tenth of all. So he meets the king of Sodom and the king of Salem. I mean, it couldn't be more further apart. The king of the wicked city, the king of the holy city. They both meet at the king's valley, which is outside of Jerusalem, according to the book of 2 Kings. So Salem made it into American, didn't it? Massachusetts and Oregon. And it is an abbreviation for Jerusalem. And he was king and priest at the same time. The law of Moses did not allow this. The law of Moses separated a worship leader from a political leader. And that example was taken over into America, you know, a separation of church and state, which we can't review totally. But here, one person, worship leader and political leader, Melchizedek. His name means king of righteousness, and Salem means peace. So the book of Hebrews calls him the king of righteousness and the king of peace. So it's pre-law. It is interesting that there were true believers before the law of Moses. You don't see many of them in Genesis, but a few. Seth and Enoch and Noah and Abram, and now we have Melchizedek, and Melchizedek was a legitimate priest doing worship services before the law of Moses. Priest of El Elyon, the Most High God. He brought out bread and wine. Makes us think of communion, and Jesus made communion first at the Last Supper. On the other hand, it was from a previous ceremony that is Passover. Looks like it goes a long way back, all the way back to Melchizedek at least, and probably before then. This is probably a blessing service for Abraham, a Thanksgiving service that he got back. Now, Melchizedek would not be a priest in the law of Moses. He did not come from Levi. He did not come from Aaron. He would not be a priest, but he was a priest before the law of Moses. So was Job, by the way, who offered burnt sacrifices. It was kind of like a family, a local, legitimate worship service pre-law. Now, the law changed it, but it was pre-law. Interesting that it will go back to the Lord Jesus Christ, and when he comes back, he will be both king and worship leader, not allowed in the law of Moses. But when Jesus returns, he will be both king and worship leader. Jesus liked to quote Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand. In other words, two lords, God the Father said to God the Son, you sit over here and rule with me. And Jesus liked to quote that. He quoted it at his trial to Caiaphas. Verse 4 of Psalm 110, that the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So, Jesus wouldn't qualify as an Old Testament priest. He's from David, not from Aaron and Levi, but he is God's choice. When he returns, he will resume Melchizedek priesthood, and he will be king and priest. Quite a few references in the book of Hebrews, and the book of Hebrews is arguing how much better the Lord Jesus Christ will be and is than the law of Moses priest. For one thing, he lives forever. And in the Old Testament, the high priest would die, here's the next one. The high priest would die, here's the next one. The high priest would die, here's the next one. And the author of Hebrews catches it right away that our intercessor lives forever. So he's able to save us forever, who come to God by him. In other words, the Lord Jesus Christ is like our high priest, and we're like priests. There's no special priesthood anymore if we kind of pick on the Catholics. They're kind of following the Old Testament, where there is a special class of priests that brings you to God. No, there isn't. Not anymore. There isn't. The Lord Jesus Christ is the high priest. We are all priests. We all come to God by the Lord Jesus Christ. And he is superior to the Old Testament priests in that he lives forever. And he constantly intercedes. That is, he brings us to God and he prays for us. That we not be harmed, that our salvation be forever. And also the Old Testament priests, not only would they die, but they did temporary animal blood over and over again. And if they'd bring it in on the Day of Atonement, about this time of year, they'd have to do it again next year, showing that it was temporary. The Lord Jesus Christ died once for all. So the Lord Jesus Christ is both king and worship leader. He is the high priest. We're all like priests. That was a big tenet of the Reformation. There is no special class of priesthood closer to God than any other believer. The Lord Jesus Christ is our high priest. Related back to the story, was Melchizedek in the Old Testament the Lord Jesus Christ appearing? Or was he what we call a type in the Old Testament? I think you can believe either one if you want to. I tend to believe that he was a type rather than actual appearance of the Lord Jesus Christ. There are going to be appearances of the Lord Jesus Christ in the book of Genesis, coming very soon, where the Lord will go to Abram's tent. And the Lord has to be God the Son. No one has seen God the Father at any time. Jesus said in John 1:18, the only begotten Son, he has declared him. There will be appearances of the Lord Jesus Christ, even in Genesis, Christophanies or Theophanies. So it did happen. Was Melchizedek one of these appearances? Could be. I tend to think not, because it's a permanent position. In the appearances of the Lord Jesus in the Old Testament or God the Son, they're like temporary. Come and go, come and go, come and go. The king of Jerusalem, the king of Salem, would be all the time. And it wouldn't be temporary. It wouldn't be coming and going. Also, the book of Hebrews gives the word likeness of Melchizedek. Jesus will be in the likeness of Melchizedek. Not he'll be Melchizedek. He'll be in the likeness of Melchizedek. There are a few lessons here about money and assets, and we can't give all of them, but God owns it all, the possessor of heaven and earth. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. All the silver is mine, all the gold is mine, Haggai 2:8. So that was the mindset here. God owns it all. As far as the tenth, it's an example in the Old Testament We're not under the law of Moses, so here's a long-standing example, but not a command. Regarding the last few verses, you might just kind of glance at them. And the king of Sodom wanted to give Abram all the spoils. Here they all are back, and Abram would not take it. Every time I think of this story, I think of Chicago and the Cicero Bible Church was a few blocks away from Al Capone. Yeah. And the rumor's always been is he offered them money and they wouldn't take it. Cicero Bible Church is still there. The Bible churches do have a magazine. I put a copy back there and back there. It's on Chicagoland. If you want to read a little bit about Al Capone, for some reason, it was again in the September-October 2020 edition about Chicago. But I've always heard he wanted to give them money and they wouldn't touch it. Of course, they lasted longer than he did. They're still there. And in the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 23, certain evil things don't want your endorsement. Don't want your money. It really would be bad public relations, would it not? But he did not want the king of Sodom's money. Okay, the main lesson here, although, I think, is what do you do when there is a life and death danger beyond an insult? And it's right now. It's ongoing right now, and there's nobody else to help. We'll pray together, and then we'll have the choir come.